Now, in the last lecture or two, I was approaching nationalism, the origins of modern nationalism, and I started to talk last time about Herder, who I said, through his writings, more than any other person, awakened the conscience of nationalism in Central Europe. And I started to talk about Herder by saying that his ideas, typically romantic ideas, the more private the experience, the deeper the truth. But that he immediately modified this individualism in two respects, or above all in one respect, the influence of history. And just as we dealt before with the importance of nature in Romanticism, with Werther, so we must now deal with the importance of history, with this kind of dimension. For it is this dimension that will lead to the awakening of national feeling, as I said last time, and Herder here is a crucial figure. History to him is returning to the childhood of nations, to the childhood of nationality. And in that childhood, he finds a link between men, a link between men that will form them into what he calls a true community, a community that isn't enforced, but which is a natural, or as we shall see, an organic community. There are no two identical languages, therefore language produces an instinctive spontaneity, an instinctive, a spontaneous uniqueness, if you like, or I should say a spontaneous cohesion, which is unique. And here Herder found, if you like, the entrance into a cohesive factor which could mitigate the loneliness of private experience, the loneliness of Werther, if you like. The tribe becomes the nation through language. It becomes, therefore, an aesthetic unity. The criteria here for unity is not political, it's not social, it's an aesthetic criteria for unity. Not political or social power, but culture is the essence of national unity. Now that is important because in Central Europe there was, especially after 1814, of course, no hope for political unity, no hope for any social unity. So by putting up the criteria as cultural or aesthetic unity, he was putting up a criteria of unity which was attainable for the people of Central Europe. When after the Peace of Vienna, after 1914, political and social unity was far away. Moreover, Herder, of course, puts this not upon reason, but upon the senses. Human reason, he tells us, has been used as an artificial concept, is an artificial concept. It is the development of the senses which is important. This is developed from childhood and refined. Above all, what is important for men is not reason but the senses, refined through the ear and the eye, through music and poetry. And here, of course, we are back, if you like, with Romanticism. Man is principally formed through aesthetic experience, through the eyes, the ears, a romantic ideas, which Herder, of course, shared with Friedrich Schiller, with the whole of German idealism, that it is the aesthetic experience of music and poetry, which forms man, which forms, if you like, man's perceptions. And the center of this aesthetic experience really becomes language for Schiller and for Herder as well, which distinguishes man from animals, which distinguishes man from the lower order of creatures. And so men's perceptions are centered on the ear and the eye, on music and poetry, poetry more than music, if you like, the aesthetic more than music, but you can take them, if you like, together. This is man's greatest achievement. Now, from this, several important things follow, both in Friedrich Schiller and in Herder. It follows that community, the experience of community, is an aesthetic experience. It's an experience of a shared language, an experience in which the poet is central. The poet and poetry is central. Now, Herder believed that this poetry came from the childhood of humanity. That's why that interest in folk, in ballads, as I told you last time, the rediscovery of the fairy tale, the rediscovery of ballads, the rediscovery of folk songs, the rediscovery of folk poetry. All this puts into the center poetry, language. Together with music, it becomes the lead, the song, the national anthem. It is all a unity, an integrative force. In other words, people could integrate or were thought to integrate themselves with aesthetic experiences, not with political or social experiences. As Herder put it in another way, people integrate themselves with an organic aesthetic totality. It is, he wrote in 1784, the inner spiritual man who uses the body only as a tool for the Geist. Now, the word Geist is a word that is not translatable in English in any simple way at all, because it is outside the experience of the Anglo-Saxons. The word Geist, what does it mean that the inner spiritual man uses the body only as a tool for the Geist? The Geist means really not spiritual, as it is always translated. That's a very wrong kind of translation. You have to use a phrase to translate it. It means the empathy of man with the larger cosmic forces. Or to put it another way, the word Geist in German means the human spirit striving for a larger unity, striving to integrate itself with a larger kind of unity. And that larger kind of unity is viewed as an aesthetic unity, as a unity of music and poetry, as an aesthetic unity, as an organic unity. Organic means natural growth, as a unity of natural growth. And inasmuch as language, music, and poetry stands at the childhood of a people, therefore it means, in effect, integrating yourself with language, music, and poetry of an organic totality, of an organic totality of the people, and the people defined in aesthetic terms, not in terms of political power, not in terms of social class at all. Now, all of this means, of course, it has, of course, a very important consequence. The important consequence is this, that what you have here is the definition of a unity, the people. A unity, the people, in terms of music, art, and poetry, and not in terms of political power or economic class. Now you will read this again in Rousseau. Indeed, the essence of Rousseau's proposal for the Constitution of Poland is based upon that. The spirit of a people is essentially the spirit of poetry, of music, an aesthetic spirit, which is communicated not through political power, not through economic power. It is communicated through aesthetic symbols. It is communicated through poetry. It's communicated through music. It's communicated to a certain extent through national monuments, but always through aesthetics. And therefore, for Herder, the definition, or Schiller, or in Eastern Europe, others, the definition of a nation is an aesthetic definition. A nation has nothing to do with political power and economic power. You'll see it from Rousseau as well. A nation presents itself through aesthetics, through beauty, through poetry, through music. A nation presents itself, therefore, as an organic unity through this kind of aesthetics. For Herder, therefore, the concept of what he calls deep and massive sentiment is integrated with a certain kind of order, with a certain kind of order, but order through shared aesthetic experience. The principle of order is a principle of order, as you will see again in Rousseau, when you read your Rousseau, through a shared aesthetic experience. That is, in a way, that makes it an orderly process. The word that we must use here is the word organic. Organic growth. Now, why the word organic? The word organic means several things. The word organic means a natural growth, not an enforced growth. A natural growth leading, if you like, to a natural community, a community of affinity, a natural community. And that organic growth is best described in Herder's terms through poetry, through folk dancing, through ideas and criterion of the beautiful. Now, what you see here, and that may make it easier for you to understand, is romanticism, but romanticism channeled into a historical dimension, controlled through a historical dimension, but through a historical dimension that goes back to ideals of childhood. Like in Werther, you have this ideal of the children, the idea of innocence, of the children who surround Charlotte constantly in Werther. But here the idea of children and childhood is projected upon the nation. Here it is projected upon the people, upon the organic whole of which you are a part. The organic whole of which you are a part. It is projected upon that. Secondly, the idea of organic means the idea of a gradual development. It means, again, an analogy to nature. Just as nature, Herder says, just as nature knows no rapid growth, it is an organic development. And you become part of history yourself through this organic development. As Herder put it, the history of Germany has never seen sudden changes. Underneath all the changes of history, sometimes very distressing changes of history, you can see the national character take place. and the analogy now between nature and the nation, the people, is the analogy of a tree. The people are like a tree which grows from its roots, regardless of what the changes. It is like a tree which has an organic growth, so that the defeat and the changes don't matter very much. There is always the people, symbolized not by its leaders, which may be traitors, but symbolized instead always by the idea of aesthetics, the idea of beauty, the symbols which do not vanish, though the people may be defeated at times. They may be oppressed. They may be dominated, as the Germans were dominated by the French, as the Germans were defeated in their wars for national liberation, and the Poles were defeated, and the Czechs were defeated in their wars of national liberation. Such defeats do not matter. They are merely episodes in national life, because national life grows organically like a tree, and political and social and economic defeat are beside the point here in this kind of theory, which is why it is so important. For what must always be before you, or before your eyes, is not only for Herder folk dances and language, it's also, if you like, an ideal which was true, they thought, in the Middle Ages, but an ideal that really comes from the 18th century. That is to say, the ideal of the peasant who owns his land and who, as Herder said, knew nothing but national honor. So that you do have an ideal of the peasant so strong in the 18th century. Remember that the more the peasant vanished in industrial society, the more people glorified the peasant. The idea which I told you before, that the true virtue is to work on the land. Because if you work on the land, you go back to the childhood of the people, against what Herder calls the anomaly of the cities, the anomaly of modernity, the anomaly of the cities, which had brought Germany and Central Europe nothing but defeat, remember. Defeat in the wars of liberation, defeat in their attempt to get national unity. And so you look back to a golden age, the golden age, the Middle Ages, but a golden age when the peasant, closest to the land, closest to the childhood of humanity. And so you get a slogan which will be of the greatest importance from this day to that, a slogan of the free man on his own acres, the free man on his own acres. Going back in a way to the childhood of the people, recapturing the childhood of the people. The peasant, the free man, the free man on his own acres, which becomes basic to nationalism of the 19th century. Free from the evils of modernity, close to the childhood of organic development, or to put it in the terms of the times, in Herder's terms, close to the roots of the tree, close to the roots of the tree, close to the organic development, close to the poetry, to the art, to the folk songs of the times. And so you find in Russia, in Germany, the young intellectuals going to the country, to learn from the peasants, something which in Russia will become very fashionable, but not only in Russia, in Germany as well, to go to the peasant, to learn from the peasant what it was like, what the nation is really like against the anomaly of the cities. You get all this kind of worship which must be, I think, familiar to some of you, because, of course, it goes into every nation, into the Jewish nation, the worship of the kibbutz, the idea that you become a better part of your people through working on the land, which is, of course, absurd. This is clear, that working on the land, why are you better from working on the land? Well, you are better, work on the land is just as automatic as work on the assembly line. Why should you be better working in the cow barn? Why is dung a better smell than the smell of grease? But everybody would say dung is better than the smell of grease because it gets you closer to your people. It gets you closer to the child. Well, sure, that's why you go and work in a kibbutz and things like that. Of course, you want to recapture pre-industrial life. Now, the important thing here is what I've already told you, that the nation is always associated with pre-industrial, with pre-industrial life, with pre-industrial ideals. Nationalism is always associated with pre-industrial symbols, with rural symbols. There is a sense, of course, that even you know that rural America is healthier than urban America. Though if you read the murders that are connected in rural America, God help you. Or if I ask my psychiatrist friends who have practices in Jefferson or Portage or in the little villages around, boy, oh boy, are they sick. I mean, really, you know. You have no idea, are they sick. But the whole myth of our society, which you know, which you share, I'm sure, that the country is better than the city. Now, all this grows, in other words, out of romanticism. All of this grows out of the new ideals of nature that you have in Werther. But the ideals of nature here are ideals which are controlled, not to chaos, not to suicide. So instead of committing suicide, you work on a kibbutz. It's much the same kind of ideal that you have here, the ideal of nature. The ideal of nature, but controlled. Controlled through what, then? Controlled through the dimension of history. You have a way to integrate yourself that Werther didn't have. You integrate yourself with your people, with the old Germans, or the old Jews, or the old Frenchmen, or whatever have you. Which is very strong. It gives you an identity. The search for identity is here solved. The search for identity is here solved. You integrate yourself with your ancestors, but that isn't saying enough. Your ancestors lived on the land. Your ancestors really exemplified very modern ideals. But modern ideals which Herder projected onto the past, ideas of virility, ideas of manliness, which come out of the wars of liberation, but which are projected onto the past of the nation. The new German, the new Jew, Max Nordau's famous contrast between the coffee house Jew and the muscular Jew. Between the coffee house German and the muscular German, yes? You, of course, prefer the muscular. I prefer the coffee house. So that what you have here is this dichotomy which becomes basic to nationalism. Some of you are coffee house anyway. As I look at you and as I know what you're doing, jazz, drumming, coffee house. Finished, yes? And then you have a whole association that goes with it, of course. Abnormal instead of normal, you know. Abnormal instead of normal, urban instead of rural, degenerate, yes, instead of other things. And I'm quite serious about that. So out of that comes this whole complex of nationalism, this whole complex of nationalism, which you have in reading, you renew yourself by reading Schiller, Wilhelm Tell, or Herder. You don't read Herder anymore, but you renew yourself in this particular way. Now we must not slight, therefore, something else. We must not slight the democratic impulse which underlies all of this. The organic is the democratic. The child of the people is a democratic impulse. Indeed, it is a democratic impulse, as you will see from Rousseau very clearly. The free man on his own acres is a democratic impulse as well. And the festivals of early nationalism, where democratic festivals, I'll come back to that, the great German festivals when the Germans beat the princes and kings and bishops, which have enslaved the nation in modern times, that we must get back in the origins when there were no princes and bishops and kings to enslave the people, when the people had this kind of organic ideal. The organic ideal, the golden age, when the peasant owned his land and knew nothing, as Herder put it then, of national honor. To summarize then, what Herder did actually is that he gave Romanticism a direction, and that he made it possible to integrate into a community of affinity, which was a national community. That the national awakening was an awakening of freedom and democracy in this sense. Because Herder condemns nothing that displays power and uniqueness. He is all in favor of Indians, of Greeks, of Persians, of any people who want their freedom. Therefore, that great enthusiasm in Europe about the Greek struggle of independence, which was the first struggle of independence after the Germans and the Poles had been defeated. You remember the poet Byron swam the Hellespont and went to Greece. And this great enthusiasm for national independence, wherever it is, because every people should have its own community of affinity. Every people's poetry and folk dancing and aesthetic expression is as good as every other people's. There is here in Herder no idea of aggression, no idea of dominance of one people over another. Every people's is as good as every other's, obviously. There is none of the hate of one people against another in Herder. Folk did not mean for Herder domination or centralization or coercion or conquest. It meant the very opposite. It meant freedom to develop organically for every people, for every people. So we must not read nationalism as it became into nationalism as it was at that time. Indeed, Herder shares with Rousseau something, we'll come back to it, the hatred of the state, the hatred of the state, the hatred of bureaucracy, the hatred of anything that stifles this kind of free development. There's a great deal of Werther in all of this, if you like, especially when you read Rousseau, you must be quite clear about that. There's a great deal of the Werther in it. Now, what is the importance of all of this? The immediate political importance is enormous. the nation represents itself as a totality, not merely as a political entity, not merely as an entity of class or social entity, but indeed as a totality, and a totality that is expressed through culture rather through anything else. And that means, of course, an emphasis on what Rousseau stresses in your reading, an emphasis on a kind of political liturgy, on the nation as expressing itself through poetry, folk dancing, theater, if you like, festivals. I'll come back to that. Festivals. The nation as presenting itself as a total kind of entity, a historical continuity that is expressed through culture, through plays like Wilhelm Tell, if you like, through a kind of culture, festivals, holy fires, and all of this kind of thing, which becomes very important. And therefore, the Declaration of National Allegiance, is through acting in a cultural realm, which seems non-political, but is highly political, because the nation will claim the whole man, literature, art, culture, and politics eventually, and power, will all be integrated into one totality. You declare your allegiance to reciting poetry, the Hungarian revolt in 1957 even started with reading of poetry, and it becomes the expression of an oppressed nation. Language, poetry, the visual. That is why the poet has now a place, a very important place in the nation and in national awakening. In all these oppressed people, the poet becomes the hero, in a way, has an important place, not only in Hungary, in Germany, with the poets of national liberation, in the Jewish national awakening with Bialik and other poets. The poet becomes all important in this kind of national awakening. And your declaration of allegiance is folk dancing, is this jumping through fires that you've never done. None of you have jumped through fires. No, no, no. You've sat at home and read Karl Marx and become the dull sticks you are. Yeah? But my national awakening was jumping through fires. Tell you that. Yeah? Obviously. And if you'd been a part of any youth movement, that's what you would have done. You would have jumped through fire. You would have recited poetry and all of these kind of things as part of your declaration, your political declaration to a political entity, and eventually your declaration of political superiority would be jumping through fire and all of this, of youth movements. No, you have never had breakfast, you know, by a fire. You have never taken trips through the historical landscape. Because there is another concept now in Herder, which becomes all important. Again, a mixture of this, the concept of the historical landscape. Because Werther's landscape is too chaotic. It has to be tamed, and it is tamed by becoming part of the organic whole of this entity. The landscape is a historical landscape. How does it become a historical landscape? Through the peasants in it, who connect you to the origins of your people. Yes. Not only that, through the historical ruins What? To the Teutoburger Forest in Germany, the old ruins of the old Germans, these old stones the old Germans left behind. In Israel or in Zionism through archaeology, it's all the same, whether it's the stones in the Teutoburger Forest or this idea of archaeology. You want to have some part of your people in nature. And so you wander through nature. And the nature is your nature because your ancestors were in it. Your ancestors were in it. So you become a historical landscape, your kind of nature in Germany and Central Europe, symbolized by the villages, the old villages, the old villages, the castles. So people built medieval castles again. The castles, yes? The whole landscape, the mythology of the landscape. And now you get revived in Germany the mythology of a famous mountain, which becomes a sacred mountain. And every nation now has a sacred mountain. The German sacred mountain is the Kyffhäuser. All right? The Jewish sacred mountain is the Masada. The French have a sacred mountain. Every nation now has to have a sacred mountain. Why? Three reasons. One, the mythology of mountains, which I told you before. Nature, the height, the mountain, the liberating from daily life, the rush to the Alps, the climbing of the mountain. But now the mountain is at home. Connected with national myth. In the Kyffhäuser, which becomes a sacred German national mountain, an old German emperor, Barbarossa, sits with his beard grown through his table in front of him. And when the nation will be united, Barbarossa will awaken and will come out of the mountain. The Savior will come out of the mountain. The national Messiah will come out of the mountain, and the Jewish Messiah will land on a mountain. Mountains are very important. Christ went to heaven from a mountain, if you don't know that. Every savior has some connection with a mountain. The symbol of nation and the symbol of the savior is the same. Christ's mountain. All the many footsteps of Christ, I can give you my favorite tour of Jerusalem, the tour of the 12 footsteps of Christ. After all, I call Jerusalem the takeoff city, yes? The cosmic airport, which it is in a sense. So what you have, therefore, here is you always have mountains and that in one coming together, yes? Always now, the sacred mountain. And in Germany, the sacred mountain will be the Kyffhäuser. Poland has its sacred mountain. Israel has its sacred mountain, Masada. Really doesn't matter. You have to have a sacred mountain. So I'm telling you that because two things are come together. The symbol of the nation and romantic nature. Nature is tamed into national symbolism by the sacred mountain. And you climb the sacred mountain, and you climb the sacred mountain with torches. With torches you climb the sacred mountain. Don't you know that? Yeah. There are only two places you do it today, obviously. In communist East Germany. Communism has to legitimize itself by nationalism. So believe it or not, in the communist East Germany, you still climb the Kyffhäuser with torches. And the other is Israel. You go up Masada either by funicular like myself, if you want to go up at all, or if you're a real patriot, you go by foot, yes? With torches, by night, wonderful. So I'm all for it. I like that sort of thing. Yes, I love that sort of thing, really. I was brought up in it. Did all that sort of thing in my youth. It's fine. But the point I want to make to you is that the beginning of nationalism stood the national landscape. And so you have something in Europe which is unknown in America because you don't have a national landscape. What's your national landscape? Your national landscape is not the Wisconsin landscape, obviously. You don't have a national landscape, properly speaking, which is a good thing, because it has meant that in America nationalism is muted. It's very difficult to get an American nationalism if we all have different national landscapes. But in Europe, everybody will have his landscape, his landscape, his landscape. Whether it is the Teutoburger Forest or wherever you were brought up or whatever has meaning, it is a European term, your own landscape. It is unknown in America. Now, I think that's a very important difference, because it means that, again, nationalism is a totality. It tames nature. Nature becomes a part of yourself, as in Werther, but it becomes much more than a part of yourself. It becomes a part of yourself, your own integration with your organic unit, your own landscape. I dare say if I asked any of you, what is your landscape? Very difficult. What is your landscape? I don't know. Mr. Fine, what is your landscape? Huh? Well, yes, sort of. But your real landscape is what? Where are you from? What? Well, yes, you're from. I thought you were from Brooklyn. How terrible. I have all these stereotypes. So obviously it was a bad example. Whatever it is, I think I have made the point. Now, if Herder tamed romanticism in this sort of thing, and Mr. Fine is lucky he has a native landscape, the Rocky Mountains, but your ancestors, my dear, were not in the Rocky Mountains, no. It's not an organic landscape at all, no. It doesn't have the same meaning. So, these ideas of Herder were broadened and were turned towards aggressiveness and domination by the second person I want to discuss, the second awakener of nationality, Fichte. And the thing about Fichte is that he went one step beyond Herder, that he turned these ideas, which don't have to be connected to domination at all. He turned them towards ideas of domination. He pushed nationalism one step further than Herder, but he did it in a very interesting way. For Fichte at the beginning was a follower of the French Revolution, was taken with the French Revolution. And his turning towards aggression and ideas of domination happened under the Napoleonic domination of Germany, happened under occupation. Now, occupation always turns or heightens nationalism. There is no real good comparative study. It'd be wonderful to want to undertake, I think, what happens to peoples under occupation. And Fichte is the first, really, who brought out the implication of what happens to a revolutionary under domination, under occupation, conditions of occupation. For Herder, of course, was a revolutionary. Fichte was a revolutionary. And we must see what happened to him under these conditions of occupation.